All right, good morning.
Morning.
It's 9 o'clock, so we're going to go ahead and get started. And I know there'll be some people that are coming in. We might actually end up with a bigger online audience today than we have in class. We'll just have to see how it goes. You should have in front of you a set of notes for Lesson 89. Lesson 89, the two streams of Bibles, model of transmission, its origin and accuracy, part 3. And today we're going to be looking at the Old Latin and Latin Vulgate dichotomy. So I want to add that, guys, after in the parentheses there where it says Old Latin and Latin Vulgate at the top in the title, I want to add dichotomy to that, okay? Okay, so I want to get started right away. As always, we got a lot to do, a lot to cover and so forth. It is Memorial Day weekend. A lot of people probably are going to be out of town. I just mentioned we might actually end up with a bigger YouTube audience this morning than we have here, but I'm going to keep making progress. There's only a few more studies before I'm going to take a break for the summer. So I'm not sure exactly how many of the following weeks I'm going to need, but I know for sure at least next week, okay? So the introduction to this lesson, in lessons 87 and 88 were devoted to looking at the origins and accuracy of the two streams of Bible's model of transmission. These last two lessons have covered the following points, okay? So number one, we looked at the two streams of Bible's view of transmission. So I just told you what the idea was. We looked at about 15 or 16 different charts, diagrams, and so forth, of different representations of that idea. Second, we looked at the historical origins of the two streams of Bible's paradigm. Specifically within the writings of Benjamin Wilkinson and our authorized Bible Vindicated. I'll have a lot more to say about that next week. Third, we looked at my first questioning of the two streams of Bible paradigm. And in Lesson 87, that took shape around looking at the Gothic translation. And then last week in Lesson 88, around the Peshitta translation. So if you remember from previous studies, okay, I've had this chart up here the last few times. So the Gothic and the Peshitta, or the Old Syriac, are always depicted as being in the pure stream of transmission, okay, on these two streams of Bible's charts. So again, the top up here in white, this is the stream of purity, and down here in gray is the stream of corruption on this particular chart, okay? So, we talked about how I started looking and questioning this when I looked at the Gothic and Peshitta translations. We covered that in Lesson 87 and 88. Today, back to the notes, today I would like to look at what happened when I went public with my private misgivings regarding the two streams of Bible's paradigm. Simply stated, this portion of my research centered around the alleged dichotomous placement of the Old Latin and Latin Vulgate in opposing streams of transmission. So if you look at the chart here, you'll see the Old Latin in the pure stream and the Vulgate down here in the corrupt stream. Okay, so there's a dichotomous dealing with the old, I'll explain what that means in a minute, with the Old Latin as being characterized as quote-unquote pure, and the Vulgate being characterized as quote-unquote corrupt, okay? So today what I want to do is I want to look at that idea. So I'll explain more in a minute, okay? So given the fact that I'm going to be talking about Jerome's Latin Vulgate in this lesson, I would like to make the following disclaimers at the outset, okay? Number one, I am not a Roman Catholic, okay? I am not a Roman sympathizing Protestant. I am a rightly dividing, mid-Acts Pauline dispensationalist who happens to be a King James Bible believer, okay? So I'm going to be saying some things about the Vulgate that are maybe more positive towards the Vulgate than things you've heard about or read about in the past. That does not mean that I am advocating for Roman Catholicism or use of the Vulgate. Okay, that brings me to the second disclaimer. I am not advocating for the use of the Latin Vulgate or the Reims New Testament. I'm going to talk about the Vulgate and I'm going to talk about the Reims New Testament, but I'm not advocating for their use. Okay? And then thirdly, I'm a King James Bible believer. I believe the King James Bible is God's word for English-speaking people. I've always believed that. Even though I'm rethinking a lot of things regarding the pro-King James position, I've never wavered from my understanding that this is God's word to me in English. What I have maintained and come to believe is that it has been poorly argued and poorly articulated in many cases, okay? And so one of my main objectives in this class is to try to do a better job of arguing for it and explaining it, alright? So the main point then today is public questioning of the two streams of Bible paradigm. Armed with textual observations gleaned from looking at the Gothic and Peshitta translations, I went public regarding my misgivings of the two streams of Bible's paradigm in the late summer and early fall of 2018. This took the form of asking some public questions about the model in two Facebook groups that are devoted to discussing issues related to the King James Bible and the textual debate. The first group is the King James Bible Debate Group, and the second group is simply called Pure Bible. So when I saw the things that I presented to you in Lesson 87 and 88 regarding the Gothic and the Peshitta, I started to ask some questions of other people that are out there to see what, if anyone else had encountered anything, okay? So to the next point. In the Pure Bible Facebook group, I was able to interact with researcher Stephen Avery. As it turned out, Avery also had misgivings about the two streams of Bible's model, but for different reasons. Instead of questioning the paradigm via the Gothic and Peshitta translations as I had, Avery's doubts were primarily centered around what he perceived to be a false dichotomy between the Old Latin and Latin Vulgate. Moreover, Avery also expressed misgivings regarding Benjamin Wilkinson, the fountainhead of the two streams notion, and his ties to Seventh-day Adventism. So there were two issues there. There's number one, the dichotomy between the Old Latin and the Latin Vulgate, which is what I'm going to talk about in this lesson. And then there's the Seventh-day Adventism of Wilkinson, the first guy who puts this idea out in his 1930 book, Our Authorized Bible Vindicated. Okay? So in this lesson, we're going to deal with the dichotomy between the Old Latin and Vulgate. And then next week in Lesson 90, we will address the Adventism of Wilkinson and the paradigm's origin. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay? So top page 2. So please recall the following points from our summary of the two streams of Bible's charts in Lesson 87. So recall from Lesson 87 that I presented to you like 15 or 16 different charts and diagrams, okay? We looked at two streams, we looked at two lines, we looked at the two trees, we looked at a bunch of different ways that this has been explained over time, okay? But what we saw was this. So three summary points. Number one, the Italia or Old Latin, Peshitta, and Gothic translations, among others, are always placed in the pure stream, thereby giving the impression that these early translations are in complete agreement with the Textus Receptus, the text of the Reformation, and the King James Bible because they are in the same stream. Okay? So here again, here's the Old Latin, here's the Peshitta, here's the Gothic. They're in the same stream as what? The King James. Okay? So I tried to point that out to you in Lesson 87. Alright? Number two, in contrast, Jerome's Latin Vulgate is always placed in the corrupt stream emanating from Alexandria, Egypt, and culminating in the various editions of the critical text and modern versions. So again, if you look up here in gray, you can see Jerome's Vulgate down here. You can see that it's in the corrupt Alexandrian stream, and that it culminates on the end here in the Vatican versions or modern versions of the Bible in English. Okay? So there's a dichotomy here between the Old Latin in the pure stream and Jerome's Vulgate in the corrupt stream, according to these charts and diagrams. Okay? Number three. Therefore, these charts depict the Old Latin, or Italia, Peshitta, and Gothic translations as, quote, good Bibles, and the Vulgate as, quote, bad. More specifically, the Old Latin and Vulgate are pitted against each other as rivals in opposing streams. Okay? So before we go any further, does everybody see what I'm saying then? Okay? So on these charts, the Jerome's Vulgate is always in the corrupt stream, and the Old Latin is always in the stream of purity. We see that here with, this is J.J. Ray's chart of the poor stream, or the corrupt stream, and there's Jerome's Vulgate. This is Peter Ruckman's, there's Jerome's Vulgate. And then we compare that to the pure line, and here you'll see the Old Latin or the Italia. You'll see the Peshitta on J.J. Ray's tree, and then you'll see the same thing on Peter Ruckman's tree. The Peshitta and the Old Latin are always on the good tree, whereas the Vulgate is always on the what? The bad tree or in the corrupt stream. Okay, is everybody following that? Okay, so I'm going to put that one back up. So, remember that the notion of placing the Waldensian Old Latin Bible in the stream of the received... Sorry, I lost my spot. Let me start over. Remember that the notion of placing the Waldensian Old Latin Bible in the stream of the received text Bibles originated with Wilkinson's 1930 book, Our Authorized Bible Vindicated. The following table is presented by Wilkinson on page 30 under the heading Two Parallel Streams of Bibles. Now, I should have put that on the presentation, but I forgot to do that. But you can see there on the left, you have your pure stream, and you can see that the Waldensian Italic Bible is in that stream, otherwise known as the Old Latin. And then you can see on the right-hand column that you have the Vulgate of the Roman Catholic Church or the Latin Vulgate in the opposing side of the column. Okay? So again, that idea of that dichotomous idea there comes or is first introduced in this particular book by Benjamin Wilkinson. Okay? Please note, now this is important, please note that Wilkinson's table places the Waldensian Italic Bible or Old Latin and Jerome's Latin Vulgate in opposing streams. In doing so, Wilkinson is inferring that the Italic Bible is, quote, good, and the Vulgate is, quote, bad or corrupt, okay? Now, that same idea, as I've already told you, shows up on this chart as well, okay? Is everybody with me so far? Okay? So, this pitting of the Old Latin against the Vulgate is an example of the logical fallacy of false dichotomy. Also known as the fallacy of false dilemma, or black or white, it presents someone with two alternative states or options as the only possibilities when in fact more possibilities exist. This tactic has the appearance of forming a logical argument, but under closer scrutiny it becomes evident that there are more possibilities than the either-or choice that is presented. This chart is presenting you an either or what?
Choice.
Choice, right? Well, if you're reading NIV, you're reading the Vatican's Bible. Now, there might be reasons for that based upon the United Bible Society text and the fact that a Roman Catholic sat on the editing committee, and there might be other reasons for that, okay? But we're not getting into those reasons today. We're talking about these streams as they've been constructed, right? This is giving you an either-or option. Well, you're either Old Latin, which is pure, or you're Jerome's Vulgate, which is what?
Corrupt,
okay? So, look at the quote there. We can define false dichotomy is when the author creates an artificial sense that there are only two possible alternatives in a situation. Is that exactly what these charts are doing? These charts are leading you to the impression that there are only how many options?
Two,
and that's it, okay? By doing that, the author limits both the reader's options and imagination. This fallacy is common when the author has an agenda and wants to give the impression that their view is the only sensible one, okay? That's a logical fallacy of false dichotomy, or false dilemma, or black or white. Those are three terms to describe the same logical fallacy, okay? And it's the idea that there are only two what? Options. Okay. In short, Wilkinson reasons as follows. Number one, since the Old Latin Bible has some distinctions from the Vulgate, and since there were only two lines of Bibles, note the circular nature of this reasoning, thus the Old Latin Bible had to be a received text Bible. Okay? So he's putting that as an either what? Or dilemma, an either or dichotomy, right? And this is what happens a lot. So if you're not wholly with this idea, then you must be where? There. Or if you're not wholly with this idea, then you must be where? Up here. This is the thinking that exists within this arena of thought, okay? Anybody have any questions or comments about that?
But the Vulgate was superseded the Old Latin, right?
I mean, we'll get to that in a minute, but yeah.
So, I would think they would both be on the same stream based on that.
So, rather than there being this great dichotomy between the Old Latin and the Latin Vulgate, they're really sister texts that have more in common with each other than differences. And that's what I'm going to try to show you here in what we're going to talk about, okay? So if you look at the next point, it's important to note that I have searched Wilkinson's book in vain for a single example of a variant reading between the Old Latin and Vulgate that would justify the establishment of such a dichotomy. Okay? He gives none. I can find no textual example. So Wilkinson is putting out this idea that the Waldensian Old Latin is pure and the Latin Vulgate is corrupt, but he gives not one textual example to substantiate this claim. What I mean by textual example is what we've done in the last two lessons, looking at specific readings and given passages, okay? He just pronounces it to be so and offers no justification textually for that, okay? So let me start that point over. It's important to note that I have searched Wilkinson's book in vain for a single example of a variant reading between the Old Latin and the Vulgate that would justify the establishment of such a dichotomy. He doesn't give any examples. Instead of offering textual evidence to support the alleged dichotomy between the Old Latin and the Vulgate, Wilkinson offers circumstantial evidence. On pages 28 and 29, just before he presents his chart of two parallel streams of Bibles on page 30, Wilkinson quotes Dr. Frederick Nolan's 1815 work, An Inquiry into the Integrity of the Greek Vulgate, to buttress his position. Now, that is this massive book right here, okay? An Inquiry into the Integrity of the Greek Vulgate. This is hard reading. I've tried to read this thing three times, and I mean, I've made it through it, but it's not easy to read, okay? So, instead of giving textual evidence for why he's drawing this dichotomy between the Old Latin and the Latin, he's going to give you a quote from this book right here by Frederick Nolan, okay? And I've quoted it for you there, that quote on the middle of page 3. So, this is the evidence that he gives to support this, okay? He says, quote, "The author perceived, without any labor of inquiry, that it derived its name from the diocese, which has been termed the Italic, as contradistinguished from the Roman. This is a supposition which receives a sufficient contradiction from the fact. The principal copies of that version have been preserved in that diocese, the metropolitan church of which it was situated in Milan. The circumstance is at present mentioned, as the author thence formed a hope that some remains of the primitive Italic version, or Old Latin, might be found in the earliest translations made by the Waldensians, who were the lineal descendants of the Italic Church, and who have asserted their independence against the usurpation of the Church of Rome, and have ever enjoyed the free use of the Scriptures." Now, I don't disagree with some of that stuff about the Waldensians, okay? "In the search to which these contradictions have led the author, his fondest expectations have been fully realized. It was furnished him with abundant proof on that point to which his inquiry was chiefly directed." So you can see why this guy's hard to read, okay? "As it has supplied him with unequivocal testimony of a truly apostolical branch of the primitive church that celebrated the text of the heavenly witnesses was adopted in the version which prevailed in the Latin church previously to the introduction of the modern one." Okay, what did all that mean? That means that the Old Latin, the Old Latin had in it 1 John 5:7, the witness of the three heavenly witnesses, the three that bear record in heaven, right? And it had it in it before Jerome had put it where? In the Vulgate. Okay? So he's saying then, that's all Frederick Nolan is saying. Frederick Nolan is saying that there's evidence from the Waldensian Bible, the Old Latin, that 1 John 5:7 had been in use by that particular church before it ended up where? In the Vulgate. Is everybody with that? Okay? Taken in context, next point, Nolan is not asserting that the Italic church used the received text without qualification. Okay? That's not what he's saying. Rather, Nolan is simply stating that the three heavenly witnesses of 1 John 5:7 were in the Old Latin and that there were some points of confluence between the Old Latin and the received text. Mark well, however, that Wilkinson is using this citation from the pen of Nolan to establish his two streams of Bibles paradigm by pitting the Bible of the Waldensians against the Latin Vulgate. So does everybody understand what he's doing? Okay? What's Wilkinson doing? He's taking the fact that 1 John 5:7 is in the Old Latin, which is what Nolan's talking about. I got the book. You can look at it if you want to establish what I'm saying. He takes that fact and then he uses it to create a dichotomy between the Vulgate and the Old what? And the Old Latin. Okay? And then he presents it, in this chart right here of his two streams of Bibles at the bottom of this page. If you go one page before, if you go one page before, you got the quotation from Frederick Nolan that I just read. So his establishment of the dichotomy between the Old Latin and the Vulgate is not based upon textual evidence, it's based upon a citation from the pen of Frederick Nolan in 1850. You guys following that? Seeing some blank stares. I hope everyone's with me. We good?
Yeah.
Okay. Regarding, so, let me go back to that point under the quote. Taken in context, Nolan is not asserting that the Italic Church used the received text without qualification. Rather, Nolan is simply stating that the three heavenly witnesses of 1 John 5:7 were in the Old Latin, and that there were some points of confluence between the Old Latin and the received text. Mark well, however, that Wilkinson is using the citation from the pen of Nolan to establish the two streams of Bibles paradigm by pitting the Bible of the Waldensians against the Latin Vulgate. So he's creating their tension based upon that citation from Nolan. Regarding the Old Latin translation, King James advocate Dr. Thomas Holland states the following. He says, quote, "The earliest Old Latin manuscripts in existence today date from the 4th century and onward. However, it is also thought that these later manuscripts strongly reflect the Old Latin New Testament that was in existence in the 2nd and 3rd centuries. Regardless of where the Old Latin originated, it is clear that it is strongly associated with the Syrian-type text, what we have called the traditional text." Okay? So is he saying the same thing? Okay? Top of page 4. Now he's going to give you an example. An example of this may be found in Mark 1:2. The traditional text reads, "as it is written in the prophets." The text of Mark then quotes two prophets, Malachi 3:1 and Isaiah 40 verse 3. The Alexandrian text reads, "as it is written in the prophet Isaiah," and then quotes the two prophets. The first reading is found in the King James Version, the New King James Version, and the traditional Greek text. It is also found in the Peshitta among Old Latin manuscripts, and then he lists them out, okay? We find the same reading as the traditional. The reading is in, and then I'm not going to read all those. Those are just identifications of different Old Latin manuscripts that read as it is written in the prophets. Okay, go to the next paragraph. The same is true for the longer ending of Mark and the story of the woman caught in adultery, known as the pericope adultery. The Alexandrian text does not contain Mark 16:9 through 20, though it is found in the majority of Greek manuscripts, the Peshitta, and almost all Old Latin manuscripts. The woman taken in adultery, found in John 7:52 through 8:11, is also the reading of the traditional Greek and found in the majority of Old Latin witnesses. End quote. Okay? Now, we got some unpacking to do here. All right? Look at the next point. Unpacking this citation from the pen of Dr. Holland, a couple summary takeaways are in order. First, as we saw last week when we looked at the Peshitta, the witness of the Old Latin, as we saw last week when we looked at the Peshitta, the witness of the Old Latin is important to King James advocates because it is viewed as antedating Aleph and B, or Codex Sinaiticus and Codex Vaticanus, the two great uncial manuscripts of the Alexandrian text type. In this way, King James advocates have inadvertently taken up the mantra of their opponents that oldest is what? Best. So why does this matter to them so much? The reason this matters to them so much is because they're trying to find evidence that those readings predate, okay, predate the readings of the two so-called oldest and best. Okay? Never mind what the actual readings are that we could demonstrate. Second, note that Dr. Holland, now this is important, okay? Note that Dr. Holland uses Mark 1:2 as a textual example that the old Latin manuscript supports the traditional text against the Alexandrian. This illustrates a point I made in lessons 87 and 88. Mark 1:2 is used by many to quickly gauge the textual basis of a given translation. Why is the old Latin in the pure stream of Bibles? Because the text reads prophets in Mark 1:2. Recall, however, from previous lessons that both the extant Gothic and Peshitta translations contain Alexandrian readings in Mark 1:2. So look at the table. What's the reading in the Gothic? Now, you can't read Gothic, I know, but you can see the capital letter on the word E that would translate into what?
Isaiah.
Then look at the Peshitta, as it is written in Isaiah the prophet. Okay, and then note in parentheses that Etheridge Peshitta translation from 1849, as well as Murdoch's from 1851, all read Isaiah the what? Now, this is supposed to be a corrupt what? A corrupt reading, right? But notice, I'm getting ahead of myself. So. According to what Dr. Holland reports regarding the Old Latin, it disagrees with both the extant Gothic and the Peshitta versions in Mark 1:2. Yet all three are placed in the same stream of transmission on various two streams of Bibles, charts, and diagrams. So look at it right here. Okay? The Old Latin says, as it is written in the prophets. The Peshitta says, Isaiah the prophet. The Gothic says what? Isaiah the prophet. But the evidence that Dr. Holland is giving that the Old Latin supports the traditional text is Mark 1:2, yet the two other Bibles that are in the same stream don't even agree with the Old Latin in that verse. You following that? But nobody ever talks about that. You with that? I know I'm saying a lot and I'm going fast. So let me start that point over. According to what Dr. Holland reports, let me back up. What's Holland's evidence that the Old Latin is traditional text King James?
Gothic and Peshitta.
No, his evidence is the reading in Mark 1:2 that it says, as it is written in the what?
Prophets.
He also cites Mark 16, the long ending of Mark, and he cites the woman taken in adultery in John, right? And those are evidence that the Old Latin is in this stream, right? But the two other ones in the same stream, as I've already demonstrated to you in lesson 87 and 88, the Gothic and the Peshitta, both read Isaiah the what? The prophet. Yet they're in the same stream as what? As the old Italian. Or the old Latin, excuse me. Okay? So according to what Dr. Holland reports regarding the old Latin, it disagrees with both the extant Gothic and Peshitta versions in Mark 1:2. Yet all three are placed in the same stream of transmission on various two streams of Bibles, charts, and diagrams. Furthermore, note that Dr. Holland said that the traditional reading of Mark 1:2, prophets, is found in the Peshitta. This conclusion does not match the findings I presented in Lesson 88. I just showed you three examples from the Peshitta where all three of them read Isaiah the what? The prophet, okay? So what does one do when Bibles placed in the same stream of transmission contradict each other in terms of their so-called characteristic readings? Now, I don't think you have to be a rocket scientist really to see the problem with this, right? Okay? Thirdly, Dr. Holland offers the extended ending of Mark 16, 9-20, and the woman taken in adultery, John 7, 53-8-11, as further textual proof that the old Latin support of the traditional readings as found in the King James Bible. This analysis leaves out the fact that the Latin Vulgate of Jerome also includes Mark 16, 9-20, as well as John 7, 53-11. Meanwhile, as we saw in Lesson 87, the Gothic Bible, a presumed emblem of textual purity, according to two streams advocates, does not contain the woman taken in adultery. Okay? So please consider the following table comparing the Peshitta, the Gothic, Old Latin, and Vulgate readings for the three passages discussed by Dr. Howland. So the only three we're looking at here is Mark 1-2, Mark 16, 9-21, and the woman taken in adultery, John 53, okay? So, let's read across the row. Mark 1-2, the Peshitta says Isaiah the prophet. The Gothic says Isaiah the prophet. The Old Latin says prophets. The Vulgate says Isaiah the prophet. But wait a minute. The Vulgate's down here, and the Gothic and the Peshitta are up there. You see that? Let's look at Mark 16. Mark 16, 9 through 20. Notice that the Peshitta contains it, the Gothic contains it, the Old Latin contains it, and the Vulgate contains it. All three of them, what? Contain it. Now look at the case of the woman taken in adultery, John 7:53 through 8:11. The evidence for the Peshitta is mixed. Some had it, some what?
Didn't.
Okay? The Gothic omits it altogether. The Old Latin contains it, and the Vulgate contains it. Yet, they're in two opposing what? Streams. Okay? So, in the case of these three readings, when judged in light of the extant evidence, the Old Latin has more in common with the Vulgate than it does with the Peshitta and the Gothic versions. Yet, two streams of Bible's literature always place the Old Latin in the same transmissional stream as the Peshitta and Gothic against the Vulgate. Is this really an accurate representation of the facts on the ground? Is the Vulgate any more corrupt than either the Peshitta or Gothic in the case of these three readings? The answer is no. All three are emblematic of a mixed text. Now, I understand that may be an inconvenient truth for some. That may be something that is just a little too hard to swallow. But the reason it's hard to swallow is because you've been lied to. Either intentionally, in the case of the people that originally started this idea going, or unintentionally, by people like me who read all this stuff and just believed it and accepted it as true. Okay? The bottom line is, though, it's not what? It's not accurate. Okay? Is everybody with that? Textually speaking, the Old Latin and the Latin Vulgate are sister texts, given that the Vulgate was originally an updating of the Old Latin by Jerome. The history of the Vulgate is that Jerome took various Old Latin manuscripts and basically edited them. Okay? History tells us that Jerome used the Old Latin as his base text in translating the Vulgate, along with assistance from some unidentified Greek manuscripts. While we cannot know for sure what manuscripts Jerome used as his textual basis, we can know with some certainty that it was not the so-called Alexandrian text, okay, as typified by Codex B. Extant copies of the Latin Vulgate containing the long ending of Mark 16, 9 through 11, whereas Codex B is one of only two Greek witnesses that omits the text. So whatever Jerome's using here when he's editing these Old Latin with some Greek to create the Vulgate, he's not using Codex Vaticanus because Mark 16 is in the long ending of Mark 16, 9 through 20 is in the Latin Vulgate. You guys following that? If he's using Codex Vaticanus, he would have left out what? Mark 16. He would have left out the woman taken in adultery. He would have left out things that it had, that critical text and so forth, that those two unseals leave out. Are we still good?
Yep.
Okay. In lessons 87 and 88, we compared the readings of the following passages in the Gothic and the Peshitta versions. Mark 1-2, Colossians 1:14, 1 Timothy 3:16, Luke 2:33, John 7:53 through 8:11, Mark 16:9 through 20, Acts 8:37, and 1 John 5:7. Now, Given that access to the old Latin Online is extremely limited, we were not able to make any comparisons beyond the ones mentioned by Dr. Holland above regarding Mark 1-2, Mark 16, 9-20, and John 7, 53-8-11, or the woman taken in adultery. That being said, we can compare the extant Latin Vulgate with the extant Peshitta and Gothic versions to determine if their placement in opposing streams of transmission is factually accurate. Okay? So we're going to look at the rest of those examples. We've already looked at Mark 1-2, Mark 16, and the woman taken in adultery. So let's look at the rest of the examples we've been using to keep it consistent. Okay? So I'm going to read across the row. Luke 2:33, the Peshitta, Joseph and his mother. The Gothic, Joseph and his mother. The Vulgate, father and mother. Now, I believe that Joseph and his mother is the correct reading here. Okay? So in this case, do the Peshitta and the Gothic agree against the Vulgate? Okay? Let's go to the next example, Acts 8:37. For the Peshitta, the evidence is mixed. Some include the verse, some do not. We saw that last week. For the Gothic, Acts 8:37 is not available because we don't have any copies available of Acts in the Gothic. And for the Vulgate, it's what? It's omitted. Okay? So far the Vulgate, if you're just looking at those two, the Vulgate's not doing very well, is it? Look at the next one. Colossians 1:14. Peshitta omits through his blood. Gothic omits through his blood. Vulgate omits through his blood. All three of them do what? Omit that phrase. In the case of 1 Timothy 3:16, the Peshitta omits God was manifest in the flesh. The Gothic omits God was manifest in the flesh, and the Vulgate omits God was manifest in the flesh. All three of them do what? Omit. And then finally, in the case of 1 John 5:7, the evidence for the Peshitta is mixed. Some have it, some don't. For the Gothic, it's not available, and for the Vulgate, it contains 1 John 5:7. Now, you factor that table in with the one above on the three previous examples, and then we get to the following point underneath, toward the bottom of page 5. Evidence gleaned from the Vulgate for the readings in question reveal that it is a mixed, that it is a mixed text, as are the Peshitta and Gothic. Folks, are these things purely monolithic as being corrupt or pure, or do they contain mixtures?
Mixtures.
Okay.
But the dichotomous nature of the chart doesn't lead you to think that way. And then what happens is you actually look at it, and then you end up in a crisis of faith.
Because somebody taught you to think about it a certain way, and then you go and you look at the evidence, and the evidence isn't what you would have expected to find. And now you have to make a choice. Are you going to totally jump ship on the King James Bible and embrace modern versions? Or are you going to go back to the drawing board and rethink how to deal with these issues? Okay? For me, jumping ship was never an option. But I knew that we had to rethink some things because it just isn't checking out. It just isn't following to be the case. The textual facts on the ground do not warrant the placement of the Latin Vulgate in an opposing stream of transmission from the Peshitta and Gothic. They don't warrant that, folks. Where one is good, two disagree. Where two are good, the other one disagrees. And sometimes all three of them are what? Bad. Okay? Before we move on, has anybody got any questions or comments? Yeah.
The Vulgate then was something that came out of different texts.
The Vulgate came out of the collating of Old Latin. So the Vulgate is, the Old Latin is in Latin, the Vulgate was in Latin. What Jerome did is he collated Old Latin manuscripts with some unidentified Greek manuscripts to create the Latin Vulgate. In like 382 or something like this AD. Okay? So the Vulgate is born out of the Old Latin, as well as some influence from some unidentified Greek manuscripts. But the evidence does not suggest that Jerome used Codex Vaticanus, because if he had, he would have no doubt left out Mark 16. Which he does not, because the Vulgate what? Has it. Does everybody follow that? Okay. Independent evidence gleaned from volume 62, no, L is 50, 72, of Bibliotheca Sacra, published in 1915, suggests that for the Book of Acts, the received text had more in common with the Vulgate than the Old Latin. In other words, the sweeping dichotomy drawn between the Old Latin and the Vulgate by the two streams paradigm breaks down when weighed against the facts. Quote, while engaged in copying fragments of Acts from the Fleury Templist, or an Old Latin manuscript, in the National Library in Paris in the year 1904, I was struck by the immense disparity between the Old Latin text and the Vulgate of Jerome. On consulting the received Greek text, I saw that the Vulgate closely allied by the allied by the Pimplist, the Vulgate and the received Greek text were combined against the Old Latin. So what does that mean?
That means the received Greek text up here and Jerome's Latin Vulgate, in the case of this instance of collating the Book of Acts, told this guy that the Latin Vulgate had more in common with the received Greek in the Book of Acts than the Old Latin. And that is totally contrary to the what? To the dichotomy of the two streams view. Okay? Is everybody with me still? You good, Sylvia? Okay. Moreover, trying to paint the Vulgate as wholly bad against the Old Latin does not make sense, given the fact that a handful of received text readings were preserved in the Latin Vulgate. This point was made by King James defender Dr. Edward F. Hills in his 1956 publication, The King James Version Defended. Now this is long, but I think we need to read this, okay? Hills says, quote, the God who brought the New Testament safely through the ancient and medieval manuscript period did not fumble when it came to transfer this text to the modern printed page. This is the conviction which guides the believing Bible student as he considers the relationship between the printed Textus Receptus and the traditional New Testament text found in the majority of the Greek New Testament manuscripts. So understand, I've been saying this for a while. The Textus Receptus is referring to a printed edition of the Greek New Testament. Okay? That is the result of a compilation of the majority New Testament Greek manuscripts. Okay? These two texts are virtually identical. There are, however, a few places in which the Textus Receptus differs from the traditional text found in the majority of the Greek New Testament manuscripts. The more important of these differences are due to the fact that Erasmus, influenced by the usage of the Latin-speaking church in which he was reared, sometimes followed the Latin Vulgate rather than the traditional Greek text. Are the readings which Erasmus thus introduced into the Textus Receptus necessarily erroneous? So let's make sure we understand what he's saying. He's saying that when Erasmus goes out here to collate and form the Textus Receptus, is he getting some of his readings from the Vulgate and not from the majority Greek witnesses?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes, that's what he's saying.
Okay. So are the readings which Erasmus thus introduced into the Textus Receptus necessarily erroneous? By no means ought we to infer this, for it is inconceivable that the divine providence, which had preserved the New Testament text during the long ages of the manuscript period, should blunder when at last this text was committed to the printed press. According to the analogy of faith, then, we conclude that the Textus Receptus, a further step in God's provided preservation of the New Testament text, circle provided, I'm not sure that should say providential, okay? A further step in God's preservation of the New Testament text, and that these few Latin Vulgate readings, which were incorporated into the Textus Receptus, were genuine readings, which had been preserved in the usage of the Latin-speaking church. Erasmus, we may well believe, was guided providentially by the common faith to include these readings in his printed Greek New Testament text. In the Textus Receptus, God corrected the few mistakes of any consequence which remain in the traditional New Testament text of the majority of the Greek manuscripts. The following are some of the most familiar and important of those relatively few Latin Vulgate readings, which, though not part of the traditional Greek text, seem to have been placed into the Textus Receptus by the direction of God's special providence, and therefore are also found in other ancient witnesses, namely Old Greek manuscripts, versions, and fathers. Now, before we look at the examples, what's he saying? He's saying there are at least 9 traditional readings in the Greek received text of Erasmus.
Where did the names go? I lost it.
Erasmus, Stephanus, Beza, and others, and ultimately in your King James Bible, that were preserved in which tradition? The Vulgate. This thing that is supposed to be holy what? Holy, evil, and corrupt. Is everybody following that? Okay, now here are the examples. Matthew 10:8. We don't have time to look all these up, okay? I want to finish this. Matthew 10:8, raise the dead, is omitted by the majority. So the phrase raise the dead in Matthew 10:8 in your King James Bible is omitted by the majority of Greek manuscripts. This reading is present, however, in Aleph, B, C, D, 1, the Latin Vulgate, and the Textus Receptus. So is that reading in the Latin Vulgate?
Yep.
Matthew 25:35. That it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophet, they parted my garments among them, and upon my vesture did they cast lots. That's present in Eusebius, circa 325. 1, and other Caesarean manuscripts. Okay, notice the Old Latin, the Vulgate, and the Textus Receptus, even though it's omitted by the majority of Greek manuscripts. So the point here is this. Are there Latin Vulgate readings in the Textus Receptus?
Yes.
Yes. And because there's Latin Vulgate readings in the Textus Receptus, are there Latin Vulgate readings in your King James Bible in English?
Yes.
Do King James advocates accept these readings as genuine and authoritative in the true text?
Yes.
But they came, in some measure, from which tradition?
Vulgate.
The Vulgate, even though the Vulgate is supposed to be holy what?
Evil and corrupt.
You following that? Okay. Now you can look at all of those. I'm not going to read all that to you. Okay? There's a lot of reading there. I'm on page 7. But I do want to look at Acts 8:37. No, there's a few that I want to point out. Look at the next one, John 3:25. Then there arose a questioning between some of John's disciples and the Jews about purifying. That phrase in your King James Bible, okay? Notice what he says there. He says that that phrase is in the Old Latin, the Vulgate, and the Textus Receptus, okay? All those read what? The Jews. As opposed to the other reading, which is at the end of that, a Jew. So some of them read a Jew, some of them read the Jews. The Old Latin, the Vulgate, and the Textus Receptus read the what?
The Jews.
Look at Acts 8:37. He quotes the whole verse. I didn't type the whole thing out. But notice this. It says, as J.A. Alexander suggested, this verse, though genuine, was omitted by many scribes, unfriendly to the practice of delaying baptism, okay, which had become common, if to prevent by the end of the 3rd century. If not prevalent by the end of the 3rd century. Hence the verse is absent from the majority of the Greek manuscripts, but is present in some of them, including E, okay, cited by Irenaeus, Cyprian, the watch, is found in the Old Latin and the Vulgate. Then look at my brackets. It is found in the Clementine Vulgate of 1598, but it is not found in Jerome's original Vulgate of roughly 390. Okay? So, we could go through all of this. This is all the same thing with all the different readings there. I do want you to look at Romans 16. The doxology at the end of the book of Romans, starting with a verse that's commonly left out of the critical text in modern versions, Romans 16:24 says, the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ be with you all. Amen. And then it gets into, now to him that has the power to establish you according to my gospel and the preaching of Jesus Christ, according to the revelation, the mystery, and so forth, right? It says in the majority of the manuscripts, this doxology is placed at the end of chapter 14. In the Latin Vulgate, the Textus Receptus is placed at the end of chapter 16. So why is it at the end of 16 and not at the end of 14?
Because
Because when Erasmus was putting together the first edition of the Receptus, he also was looking at the Vulgate, and the Vulgate had it where?
16.
At the end of chapter 16. You guys following that? Okay, so let's go to page 8. Regardless of how one views Hill's statements regarding providence, noting the following takeaways from this citation is essential. First, of the 9 examples of Vulgate readings found in the received text and King James Bible cited by Dr. Hills, the Old Latin translation is mentioned 4 times. Matthew 25, John 3, Acts 8, 37, and Acts 9, 5. Okay? In these 4 instances, the Vulgate is also explicitly mentioned as agreeing with the Old Latin as to the authenticity of the received text reading. This data does not suggest a dichotomous relationship between the Old Latin and the Latin Vulgate, as Two Streams advocates have suggested. Rather, the Vulgate is a descendant of the Old Latin, possessing more confluence with its Latin predecessors than with Codex Sinaiticus and Codex Vaticanus. Yet in Two Streams' argumentation, the Old Latin and the Vulgate are placed in opposite streams of transmission. Such a placement misrepresents the facts which show the Old Latin and Vulgate to be more closely aligned against Aleph and V than against each other. Okay? So do they agree with themselves together against Aleph and B more often than they disagree with each other? But that's totally not what you get when you look at this chart. You get the opposite one, understanding and impression. Second, how does it make sense to paint the Vulgate as wholly bad, evil, or corrupt if it is helpful to establish the authenticity of certain received text King James readings? Does that make any sense?
No.
I mean, it can't be the it can't be the spawn of Satan until when you need it to make your argument. Okay? So here's what I'm saying. Not only is it not true that there's this huge dichotomy between the Old Latin and the Latin Vulgate, but traditional King James advocates actually, to some degree, need the Vulgate to help establish certain what?
Reading.
Certain readings. Thirdly, did I finish that?
No.
Oh. Second, how does it make sense to paint the Vulgate as wholly bad, evil, corrupt, if it is helpful to establish the authenticity of certain received text King James readings? In this case, it is anti-Catholic bias on the part of fundamentalists that has demonized the Vulgate out of hand rather than looking at its actual what? So the thought process is anything that smacks of Catholicism has to be what?
Bad.
I'll be the first one to tell you that most of what Catholicism stands for I find to be false and heresy. Okay? But just because something, in this case, wouldn't it be a better argument to make the argument based on the actual content of the readings than to just slap a bad tag on it just because it came from something that had something to do with Catholicism? By the way, our friend Erasmus, was he also reared in Catholicism? Ooh, shake your head yes. He was. More about him next term. Thirdly, though not covered by Hills, when judged against the mixed extant witnesses for the Peshitta and Gothic versions, the Vulgate is no less mixed. Why then do the Peshitta and Gothic get placed in the pure stream of transmission while the Vulgate is relegated to the corrupt stream? When judged by the extant evidence, the situation is not so clear-cut as the dichotomous reasoning of the Two Streams paradigm would have us believe. The fact is that when the Peshitta, Gothic, and Vulgate are judged against the twin standards of the received text in Greek and the King James Bible in English, all 3 are mixed texts, and the two streams of transmission notion thereby dries up. You following that? Okay. We good to go on?
Mm-hmm.
Lastly, the Catholic Reims New Testament of 1582 is always placed in the corrupt, in the stream of corrupt Bibles, along with modern versions such as the NIV, New American Standard, English Standard, ESV, and New King James. Okay? So, if you look out over here, here's the Douay. Here's your modern versions here. I'm going to go back up one, okay, to the corruption, actually up two. So here's the tree of Ruckman. You can see the Douay of 1582. And then you see the modern versions up here. Here's J.J. Ray. He's got the Clementine Vulgate here. He's got, see, there's two Vulgates. There's Jerome's and there's the Clementine Vulgate. And then he doesn't actually, oh, yeah, he does. He's got the Douay right here, 1582, right? Those are all viewed as what?
Corrupt.
Okay? The following portion of a meme is very popular on Facebook and other social media websites. It says, almost all modern versions, including the NIV, remove 16 entire verses from the New Testament. And then they list them out for you. So all these are totally removed from the New Testament, the NIV, and modern versions. Okay? Go to page 9. So I downloaded a PDF copy of the original Reims New Testament and checked to see if the 16 verses listed on the meme above were omitted. So I went to the internet and I looked for Reims New Testament, 1582, right? Is that the right year? Yeah. 1582, and I found it for free. I downloaded the PDF. I looked at it. I looked up all 16 of these verses that are identified here on this meme. Okay? My investigation revealed that all 16 verses that are missing from modern versions were present in the Reims New Testament of 1582. All 16 of them. Textually, one would be better off reading a Reims New Testament than they would be reading using a modern version. Now, that is so counterintuitive to what I was ever been told that I had to sit at home and literally think about that for a few days. Okay? Yet the Reims and modern versions are listed in the same stream of transmission. Now, don't misunderstand me, people watching me or whatever. I'm not saying go get yourself a Reims. It's not what I'm saying. Because there are issues with the Reims. Mark 1, 2. Okay? There are issues with it. But there are fewer issues with it than there are with an NIV. Okay? So, let's get the conclusion. Let me just say, how is that possible? That shows you where modern textual criticism has taken the understanding of the Bible. Okay, so you have American Protestants that are sitting in churches that are using NIVs or ESVs or New American Standards, and they're completely oblivious to what's been going on with the history of the text. Okay? Conclusion. The two streams of Bible's model of transmission is guilty of presenting a false dichotomy that is not supported by the textual facts. This is dangerous because if one bothers to check the facts, they run the risk of having their faith overthrown by information that does not fit the either or option presented by the dichotomy. You follow what I'm saying there? I can't, when I started to see this stuff, I was very upset and troubled and disturbed. And so I get there are people watching this and so forth, and they're writing me and they're saying, are you, you know, well, what does this mean? And they're having a panic attack just about. And I get why. But what I'm saying is, does the Bible ever teach you, does the Bible teach two streams of transmission?
No.
Does not. Does the Bible teach that God would preserve His Word?
Yes.
Does the Bible teach that the enemy is going to, adversary is going to seek to corrupt the Word?
Yes.
But He never said that it's going to happen in two what?
Streams.
It just said that there would be preservation and there would be what? Corruption. This whole, that whole model there of the two streams, that is man trying to explain something without necessarily checking the what? The facts of the case. I believe there is a third option, and I believe that the problem is the dichotomous nature of this, where it's an either or. Okay? So go back to the, so back to that point. The two streams of Bible's model of transmission is guilty of presenting a false dichotomy that is not supported by the textual facts. This is dangerous because if one bothers to check the facts, they run the risk of having their faith overthrown by information that does not fit the either-or option presented by the dichotomy. Bible believers need not fret over the facts on the ground. The Bible does not teach the two streams dichotomy. Rather, the Bible teaches that God would preserve His Word and that Satan would attempt to corrupt it. The dichotomy was developed in the 20th century as a rhetorical device, to answer the attacks of modern textual criticism against the received text in the King James Bible and stave off the incursion of modern Bibles into the English-speaking church. Does everybody understand what I'm saying? We are working towards being able to fully articulate an alternative model. So instead of giving you an either-or dichotomy here, I'm saying, there's another way to what? There's another way to do this, right? That still maintains belief in preservation, that still and by the way, a lot of it has to do with getting rid of the false standard of verbatim identicality. When you get rid of the false standard of verbatim identicality, now you're able to do an honest evaluation of the facts, and you don't have to pigeonhole things into an either or, you're able to look at things for what they are. Okay? So, in the next lesson, we will fix our gaze upon Benjamin Wilkinson, the fountainhead of the two streams model. Alright, does anybody have any questions? We got maybe a few minutes, we can take a couple questions. So, it's a quotation of two prophets. Okay? Not one. So for me, it's a factual issue. If he's quoting from Malachi and Isaiah, then he's not quoting. You could read the portion of that quote that's from Malachi. You could read Isaiah for the rest of your life and not find the quote that the text is telling you is in Isaiah.
It seems like that the Vulgate was placed in the corrupt line just based on Mark 1-2.
I don't even know. Well, that may be true, but if that's true, the first guy who did it didn't give any textual evidence for why he put it there.
Yeah, right.
Other than the Bible of the Waldensians is good and the Bible of the Catholic Church is bad. I mean, that's really the nature of the reasoning there. There's no textual evidence given in this book for why the Vulgate goes on one side and the other one goes on the other than he just says so. And one quote from Nolan that's specific to 1 John 5:7, that's not rubber stamping the entire thing in one side or the other the way that Wilkinson did.
I wonder why Jerome changed it. In the old Latin, it said prophets, and then he changed it to.
Well, I think he probably had in front of him some sort of a Western Greek manuscript that said that there, because the Gothic says the same thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
She's not saying.
So the Mark 1-2, as it is written in the prophets, behold. So that's found in Isaiah and Malachi?
No. So let's look at it, okay? Verse 1-2. As it is written in the prophets, okay? The statement, behold, I send my messenger before thy face, which shall prepare the way before thee. That's Malachi 3:1.
Okay.
That's not in Isaiah. The next verse, verse 3, the voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare ye the way of the Lord, make his path straight. That is from Isaiah chapter 40, verse 3.
Okay.
So the quotation there is from two separate prophets, not from Isaiah. Part of it's from Isaiah, but part of it's not. Now, I've written a paper about this, about the gymnastics that people will try to do to say why Isaiah the prophet is still right, even though it's clearly a citation from two what? Two separate prophets. Okay? Now, in my opinion, that is a factual mistake. To say Isaiah the prophet is a factual mistake because it's not coming from just one prophet, it's coming from what? Two, to say, as is written in the prophets, plural, is a factually accurate statement because that's exactly what Mark is doing. Quoting from how many prophets?
Two.
Okay? So that's why that verse is used by many as an easy sort of barometer to determine what's being translated. Okay? Anybody else? All right. Well, certainly been interesting. I appreciate your patience with this. You need to understand that to some degree, what we've been doing the last 3 weeks is breaking new ground on this whole discussion. Okay? And I don't say that to toot my own horn. I say that to clue you in on the relevancy of what we're doing here. We might be only, 10, 15 people in here, but there are other people that are watching this. All right? Thanks for your attention.